the canoeing lake, the stables, which Chiron didn't seem to like very much, the javelin range, the sing-along amphitheater, and the arena where Chiron said they held sword and spear fights. "Sword and spear fights?" I asked. "Cabin challenges and all that," he explained. "Not lethal, usually. Oh, yes, and there's the mess hall." Chiron pointed to an outdoor pavilion framed in white Grecian columns on a hill overlooking the sea. There were a dozen stone picnic tables, no roof, no walls. "What are you doing at Rains?" I asked. Chiron looked at me as if I'd gone a little weird.
"We still have to eat, don't we?"
I decided to drop the subject. Finally, he showed me the cabins. There were 12 of them, nestled in the woods by the lake. They were arranged in a U, with 2 at the base and 5 in a row on either side, and they were without doubt the most bizarre collection of buildings I'd ever seen. Except for the fact that each had a large brass number above the door, odds on the left side, evens on the right. They looked absolutely nothing alike. Number 9 had smokestacks like a tiny factory. Number 4 had tomato vines on the walls and a roof made out of real grass. 7 seemed to be made of solid gold, which gleamed so much in the sunlight it was almost impossible to look at. They all faced a commons area about the size of a soccer field, dotted with Greek statues, fountains, flower beds, and a couple of basketball hoops, which were more my speed. In the center of the field was a huge stone-lined fire pit. Even though it was a warm afternoon, the hearth smoldered. A girl about 9 years old was tending the flames, poking the coals with a stick. The pair of cabins at the head of the field, numbers 1 and 2, looked like his and hers mausoleums, big white marble boxes with heavy columns in front. Cabin 1 was the biggest and bulkiest of the 12. Its polished bronze doors shimmered like a holograph, so that from different angles, lightning bolts seemed to streak across them. Cabin 2 was more graceful somehow, with slimmer columns garlanded with pomegranates and flowers. The walls were carved with images of peacocks. "Zeus and Hera?" I guessed. "Correct," Chiron said. "Their cabins look empty." "Several of the cabins are, that's true. No one ever stays in 1 or 2. "Okay, so each cabin had a different god, like a mascot. 12 cabins for the 12 Olympians. But why would some be empty?" I stopped in front of the first cabin on the left, cabin 3. It wasn't high and mighty like cabin 1, but long and low and solid. The outer walls were of rough gray stone embedded with pieces of seashell and coral, as if the slabs had been hewn straight from the bottom of the ocean floor. I peeked inside the open doorway, and Chiron said, "Oh, I wouldn't do that." Before he could pull me back, I caught the salty scent of the interior, like the wind on the shore at Montauk. The interior walls glowed like abalone. There were 6 empty bunk beds with silk sheets turned down, but there was no sign anyone had ever slept there. The place felt so sad and lonely, I was glad when Chiron put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Come along, Percy." Most of the other cabins were crowded with campers. Number 5 was bright red, a real nasty paint job, as if the color had been splashed on with buckets and fists. The roof was lined with barbed wire. A stuffed wild boar's head hung over the doorway, and its eyes seemed to follow me. Inside, I could see a bunch of mean-looking kids, both girls and boys, arm-wrestling and arguing with each other while rock music blared. The loudest was a girl maybe 13 or 14. She wore a size XXXL Camp Half-Blood t-shirt under a camouflage jacket. She zeroed in on me and gave me an evil sneer. She reminded me of Nancy Bobafit, though the camper girl was much bigger and tougher looking, and her hair was long and stringy and brown instead of red. I kept walking, trying to stay clear of Chiron's hooves. "We haven't seen any other centaurs," I noticed. "No," said Chiron sadly. "My kinsmen are a wild and barbaric folk, I'm afraid. You might encounter them in the wilderness or at major sporting events, but you won't see any here." "You said your name was Chiron. Are you really..." He smiled down at me.
"The Chiron from the stories? Trainer of Hercules and all that?"
"Yes, Percy, I am,"
But shouldn't you be dead? Chiron paused as if the question intrigued him. I honestly don't know about should be. The truth is, I can't be dead. You see, eons ago the gods granted my wish. I could continue the work I loved. I could be a teacher of heroes as long as humanity needed me. I gained much from that wish, and I gave up much. But I'm still here, so I can only assume I'm still needed. I thought about being a teacher for 3,000 years. It wouldn't have made my top 10 things to wish for list. Doesn't it ever get boring? No, no, he said. Horribly depressing at times, but never boring. Why depressing? Chiron seemed to turn hard of hearing again. Oh, look, he said. Annabeth is waiting for us. The blonde girl I'd met at the big house was reading a book in front of the last cabin on the left, number 11. When we reached her, she looked over me critically, like she was still thinking about how much I drooled. I tried to see what she was reading, but I couldn't make out the title. I thought my dyslexia was acting up. Then I realized the title wasn't even English. The letters looked Greek to me. I mean, literally Greek. There were pictures of temples and statues and different kinds of columns like those in an architecture book. Annabeth, Chiron said, I have master's archery class at noon. Would you take Percy from here?
Yes, sir.
Cabin 11, Chiron told me, gesturing toward the doorway. Make yourself at home. Out of all the cabins, 11 looked the most like a regular old summer camp cabin with the emphasis on old. The threshold was worn down, the brown paint peeling. Over the doorway was one of those doctor symbols, a winged pole with two snakes wrapped around it. What did they call it? A caduceus. Inside it was packed with people, both boys and girls, way more than the number of bunk beds. Sleeping bags were spread all over on the floor. It looked like a gym where the Red Cross had set up an evacuation center. Chiron didn't go in. The door was too low for him, but when the campers saw him, they all stood and bowed respectfully. Well then, Chiron said, good luck, Percy. I'll see you at dinner. He galloped away toward the archery range. I stood in the doorway looking at the kids. They weren't bowing anymore. They were staring at me, sizing me up. I knew this routine. I'd gone through it at enough schools. Well, Annabeth prompted, go on. So, naturally, I tripped coming in the door and made a total fool of myself. There were some snickers from the campers, but none of them said anything. Annabeth announced, Percy Jackson, meet cabin 11. Regular or undetermined? Somebody asked. I didn't know what to say, but Annabeth said, undetermined. Everybody groaned. A guy who was a little older than the rest came forward. Now, now, campers. That's what we're here for. Welcome, Percy. You can have that spot on the floor, right over there. The guy was about 19, and he looked pretty cool. He was tall and muscular, with short-cropped sandy hair and a friendly smile. He wore an orange tank top, cutoffs, sandals, and a leather necklace with five different colored clay beads. The only thing unsettling about his appearance was a thick white scar that ran from just beneath his right eye to his jaw like an old knife slash. This is Luke, Annabeth said, and her voice sounded different somehow. I glanced over and could have sworn she was blushing. She saw me looking, and her expression hardened again. He's your counselor for now. For now? I asked. You're undetermined, Luke explained patiently. They don't know what cabin to put you in, so you're here. Cabin 11 takes all newcomers, all visitors. Naturally, we would. Hermes, our patron, is the god of travelers. I looked at the tiny section of floor they'd given me. I had nothing to put there to mark it as my own. No luggage, no clothes, no sleeping bag. Just the Minotaur's horn. I thought about setting that down, but then I remembered that Hermes was also the god of thieves. I looked around at the campers' faces, some sullen and suspicious, some grinning stupidly, some eyeing me as if they were waiting for a chance to pick my pockets. How long will I be here? I asked. Good question, Luke said. Until you're determined. How long will that take? The campers all laughed. Come on, Annabeth told me.
I'll show you the volleyball court. I've already seen it. Come on.
She grabbed my wrist and dragged me outside. I could hear the kids of Cabin 11 laughing behind me.
When we were a few feet away, Annabeth said, Jackson, you have to do better than that.
What? She rolled her eyes and mumbled under her breath.
I can't believe I thought you were the one.
What's your problem?
I was getting angry now. All I know is I kill some bull guy.
Don't talk like that, Annabeth told me. You know how many kids at this camp wish they'd had your chance?
To get killed?
To fight the Minotaur. What do you think we trained for?
I shook my head. Look, if the thing I fought really was the Minotaur, the same one in the stories,
yes,
then there's only one,
yes,
and he died like a gajillion years ago, right? Theseus killed him in the labyrinth, so...
Monsters don't die, Percy. They can be killed, but they don't die.
Oh, thanks. That clears it up. They don't have souls like you and me. You can dispel them for a while, maybe even for a whole lifetime if you're lucky. But they are primal forces. Chiron calls them archetypes. Eventually, they reform.
I thought about Mrs. Dodds.
You mean, if I killed one accidentally with a sword?
Your math teacher.
That's right. She's still out there. You just made her very, very mad.
How did you know about Mrs. Dodds?
You talk in your sleep.
You almost called her something? A fury?
They're Hades torturers, right?
Annabeth glanced nervously at the ground as if she expected it to open up and swallow her.
You shouldn't call them by name, even here. We call them the kindly ones, if we have to speak of them at all.
Look, is there anything we can say without it thundering?
I sounded whiny, even to myself, but right then I didn't care.
Why do I have to stay in Cabin 11 anyway? Why is everybody so crowded together? There are plenty of empty bunks right over there.
I pointed to the first few cabins, and Annabeth turned pale.
You don't just choose a cabin, Percy. It depends on who your parents are, or your parent.
She stared at me, waiting for me to get it.
My mom is Sally Jackson, I said. She works at the candy store in Grand Central Station. At least she used to.
I'm sorry about your mom, Percy, but that's not what I mean. I'm talking about your other parent, your dad.
He's dead. I never knew him.
Annabeth sighed. Clearly, she'd had this conversation before with other kids.
Your father's not dead, Percy.
How can you say that? You know him?
No, of course not.
Then how can you say, because I know you? You wouldn't be here if you weren't one of us.
You don't know anything about me.
No?
She raised an eyebrow.
I bet you moved around from school to school. I bet you were kicked out of a lot of them.
How?
Diagnosed with dyslexia. Probably ADHD, too.
I tried to swallow my embarrassment.
What does that have to do with anything?
Taken together, it's almost a sure sign. The letters float off the page when you read, right? That's because your mind is hardwired for ancient Greek. And the ADHD, you're impulsive, can't sit still in the classroom. That's your battlefield reflexes. In a real fight, they keep you alive. As for the attention problems, that's because you see too much, Percy, not too little. Your senses are better than a regular mortal's. Of course the teachers want you medicated. Most of them are monsters. They don't want you seeing them for what they are.
You sound like you went through the same thing?
Most of the kids here did. If you weren't like us, you couldn't have survived the Minotaur, much less the ambrosia and nectar.
Ambrosia and nectar?
The food and drink we were giving you to make you better. That stuff would have killed a normal kid. It would have turned your blood to fire and your bones to sand, and you'd be dead. Face it, you're a half-blood.
A half-blood? I was reeling with so many questions I didn't know where to start.
Then a husky voice yelled, "Well, a newbie."
I looked over. The big girl from the ugly red cabin was sauntering toward us. She had three other girls behind her, all big and ugly and mean-looking like her, all wearing camo jackets.
Clarice, Annabeth sighed, why don't you go polish your spear or something?
Sure, Miss Princess, the big girl said, so I can run you through with it Friday night.
Arete es Caracas, Annabeth said, which I somehow understood was Greek for go to the crows, though I had a feeling it was a worse curse than it sounded.
You don't stand a chance.
We'll pulverize you, Clarice said, but her eye twitched. Perhaps she wasn't sure she could follow through on the threat. She turned toward me. Who's this little runt?
Percy Jackson, Annabeth said. Meet Clarice, daughter of Ares.
I blinked. Like the war god?
Clarice sneered. You got a problem with that?
No, I said, recovering my wits. It explains the bad smell.
Clarice growled. We got an initiation ceremony for newbies, Prissy.
Percy.
Whatever. Come on, I'll show you.
Clarice, Annabeth tried to say.
Stay out of it, wise girl.
Annabeth looked pained, but she did stay out of it, and I didn't really want her help. I was the new kid. I had to earn my own rep. I handed Annabeth my minotaur horn and got ready to fight. But before I knew it, Clarice had me by the neck and was dragging me toward a cinder block building that I knew immediately was the bathroom. I was kicking and punching. I'd been in plenty of fights before, but this big girl Clarice had hands like iron. She dragged me into the girls' bathroom. There was a line of toilets on one side and a line of shower stalls down the other. It smelled just like any public bathroom, and I was thinking, as much as I could think with Clarice ripping my hair out, that if this place belonged to the gods, they should have been able to afford classier johns. Clarice's friends were all laughing, and I was trying to find the strength I'd used to fight the Minotaur, but it just wasn't there.
Like he's big three material, Clarice said as she pushed me toward one of the toilets. Yeah, right. Minotaur probably fell over laughing. He was so stupid-looking.
Her friend snickered. Annabeth stood in the corner, watching through her fingers. Clarice bent me over on my knees and started pushing my head toward the toilet bowl. It reeked like rusted pipes and, well, like what goes into toilets. I strained to keep my head up. I was looking at the scummy water, thinking, I will not go into that. I won't.
Then something happened. I felt a tug in the pit of my stomach. I heard the plumbing rumble, the pipe shudder. Clarice's grip on my hair loosened. Water shot out of the toilet, making an arc straight over my head, and the next thing I knew, I was sprawled on the bathroom tiles with Clarice screaming behind me. I turned just as water blasted out of the toilet again, hitting Clarice straight in the face so hard it pushed her down onto her butt. The water stayed on her like the spray from a fire hose, pushing her backward into a shower stall. She struggled, gasping, and her friends started coming toward her, but then the other toilets exploded too, and six more streams of toilet water blasted them back. The showers acted up too, and together all the fixtures sprayed the camouflaged girls right out of the bathroom, spinning them around like pieces of garbage being washed away. As soon as they were out the door, I felt the tug in my gut lessen, and the water shut off as quickly as it had started. The entire bathroom was flooded. Annabeth hadn't been spared. She was dripping wet, but she hadn't been pushed out the door. She was standing in exactly the same place, staring at me in shock. I looked down and realized I was sitting in the only dry spot in the whole room. There was a circle of dry floor around me. I didn't have one drop of water on my clothes, nothing. I stood up, my legs shaky. Annabeth said, "How did you..."
"I don't know." We walked to the door. Outside, Clarice and her friends were sprawled in the mud, and a bunch of other campers had gathered round to gawk.
Clarice's hair was flattened across her face, her camouflage jacket was sopping, and she smelt like sewage. She gave me a look of absolute hatred. "You are dead, new boy. You are totally..."
I probably should have let it go, but I said, "You want to gargle with toilet water again, Clarice? Close your mouth." Her friends had to hold her back. They dragged her toward cabin 5 while the other campers made way to avoid her flailing feet. Annabeth stared at me. I couldn't tell whether she was just grossed out or angry at me for dousing her.
"What?" I demanded. "What are you thinking?"
"I'm thinking," she said, "that I want you on my team for Capture the Flag."
Chapter 7. My dinner goes up in smoke. Word of the bathroom incident spread immediately. Wherever I went, campers pointed at me and murmured something about toilet water, or maybe they were just staring at Annabeth, who was still pretty much dripping wet. She showed me a few more places: the metal shop, where kids were forging their own swords, the arts and crafts room, where satyrs were sandblasting a giant marble statue of a goat man, and the climbing wall, which actually consisted of two facing walls that shook violently, dropped boulders, sprayed lava, and clashed together if you didn't get to the top fast enough. Finally, we returned to the canoeing lake, where the trail led back to the cabins.
"I've got training to do," Annabeth said flatly. "Dinner's at 7:30. Just follow your cabin to the mess hall."
"Annabeth? Sorry about the toilets."
"Whatever. It wasn't my fault."
She looked at me skeptically, and I realized it was my fault. I'd made water shoot out of the bathroom fixtures. I didn't understand how, but the toilets had responded to me. I had become one with the plumbing.
"You need to talk to the Oracle," Annabeth said.
"Who?"
"Not who, what. The Oracle? I'll ask Chiron." I stared into the lake, wishing somebody would give me a straight answer for once.
I wasn't expecting anybody to be looking back at me from the bottom, so my heart skipped a beat when I noticed two teenage girls sitting cross-legged at the base of the pier, about 20 feet below. They wore blue jeans and shimmering green t-shirts, and their brown hair floated loose around their shoulders as minnows darted in and out. They smiled and waved as if I were a long-lost friend. I didn't know what else to do. I waved back.
"Don't encourage them," Annabeth warned. "Naiads are terrible flirts."
"Naiads?" I repeated, feeling completely overwhelmed.
"That's it. I want to go home now."
Annabeth frowned. "Don't you get it, Percy? You are home. This is the only safe place on Earth for kids like us."
"You mean mentally disturbed kids?"
"I mean not human. Not totally human, anyway. Half human."
"Half human and half what?"
"I think you know."
I didn't want to admit it, but I was afraid I did. I felt a tingling in my limbs, a sensation I sometimes felt when my mom talked about my dad.
"God?" I said.
"Half God."
Annabeth nodded. "Your father isn't dead, Percy. He's one of the Olympians."
"That's crazy."
"Is it? What's the most common thing gods did in the old stories? They ran around falling in love with humans and having kids with them. Do you think they've changed their habits in the last few millennia?"
"But those are just..."
I almost said myths again. Then I remembered Chiron's warning that in 2,000 years, I might be considered a myth.
"But if all the kids here are half-gods..."
"Demigods," Annabeth said. "That's the official term, or half-bloods."
"Then who's your dad?"
Her hands tightened around the pier railing. I got the feeling I'd just trespassed on a sensitive subject.
"My dad is a professor at West Point," she said. "I haven't seen him since I was very small. He teaches American history."
"He's human."
"What? You assume it has to be a male god who finds a human female attractive? How sexist is that?"
Who's your mom, then?"
"Cabin 6.
"Meaning?"
Annabeth straightened.
"Athena, goddess of wisdom and battle."
"Okay," I thought. "Why not?"
"And my dad?"
"Undetermined," Annabeth said.
"Like I told you before, nobody knows."
"Except my mother, she knew."
"Maybe not, Percy. Gods don't always reveal their identities."
"My dad would have. He loved her."
Annabeth gave me a cautious look. She didn't want to burst my bubble.
Maybe you're right. Maybe he'll send a sign. That's the only way to know for sure. Your father has to send you a sign claiming you as his son. Sometimes it happens.
You mean sometimes it doesn't? Annabeth ran her palm along the rail.
The gods are busy. They have a lot of kids, and they don't always...
Well, sometimes they don't care about us, Percy. They ignore us. I thought about some of the kids I'd seen in the Hermes cabin, teenagers who looked sullen and depressed, as if they were waiting for a call that would never come. I'd known kids like that at Yancey Academy, shuffled off to boarding school by rich parents who didn't have the time to deal with them. But gods should behave better.
So I'm stuck here, I said. That's it, for the rest of my life?
It depends, Annabeth said. Some campers only stay the summer. If you're a child of Aphrodite or Demeter, you're probably not a real powerful force. The monsters might ignore you, so you can get by with a few months of summer training and live in the mortal world the rest of the year. But for some of us, it's too dangerous to leave. We're year-rounders. In the mortal world, we attract monsters. They sense us. They come to challenge us. Most of the time, they'll ignore us until we're old enough to cause trouble, about 10 or 11 years old. But after that, most of the demigods either make their way here or they get killed off. A few manage to survive in the outside world and become famous. Believe me, if I told you the names, you'd know them. Some don't even realize they're demigods, but very, very few are like that.
So monsters can't get in here?
Annabeth shook her head.
Not unless they're intentionally stocked in the woods or specially summoned by someone on the inside.
Why would anybody want to summon a monster?
Practice fights. Practical jokes.
Practical jokes. The point is, the borders are sealed to keep mortals and monsters out. From the outside, mortals look into the valley and see nothing unusual, just a strawberry farm.
So, you're a year-rounder?
Annabeth nodded. From under the collar of her t-shirt, she pulled a leather necklace with 5 clay beads of different colors. It was just like Luke's, except Annabeth's also had a big gold ring strung on it, like a college ring.
I've been here since I was 7, she said.
Every August, on the last day of summer session, you get a bead for surviving another year. I've been here longer than most of the counselors, and they're all in college.
Why did you come so young?
She twisted the ring on her necklace.
None of your business.
Oh. I stood there for a minute in uncomfortable silence.
So I could just walk out of here right now if I wanted to?
It would be suicide, but you could, with Mr. D's or Chiron's permission.
But they wouldn't give permission until the end of the summer session unless...
Unless...
You were granted a quest, but that hardly ever happens. The last time...
Her voice trailed off. I could tell from her tone that the last time hadn't gone well.
Back in the sick room, I said, when you were feeding me that stuff...
Ambrosia?
Yeah.
You asked me something about the summer solstice.
Annabeth's shoulders tensed.
So you do know something?
Well, no. Back at my old school, I overheard Grover and Chiron talking about it. Grover mentioned the summer solstice. He said something like, we didn't have much time because of the deadline.
What did that mean?
She clenched her fists.
I wish I knew. Chiron and the satyrs, they know, but they won't tell me. Something is wrong in Olympus, something pretty major. Last time I was there, everything seemed so normal.
You've been to Olympus?
Some of us year-rounders, Luke and Clarice and I and a few others, we took a field trip during winter solstice. That's when the gods have their big annual council.
But how did you get there?
The Long Island Railroad, of course. You get off at Penn Station. Empire State Building, special elevator to the 600th floor.
She looked at me like she was sure I must know this already.
You are a New Yorker, right?
Oh, sure.
As far as I knew, there are only 102 floors in the Empire State Building, but I decided not to point that out.
Right after we visited, Annabeth continued, the weather got weird, as if the gods had started fighting.
A couple of times since, I've overheard satyrs talking. The best I can figure out is that something important was stolen, and if it isn't returned by summer solstice, there's gonna be trouble. When you came, I was hoping, Athena can get along with just about anybody, except for Ares. And of course she's got the rivalry with Poseidon, but aside from that, I thought we could work together. I thought you might know something. I shook my head. I wished I could help her, but I felt too hungry and tired and mentally overloaded to ask any more questions. I've got to get a quest, Annabeth muttered to herself. I'm not too young. If they would just tell me the problem. I could smell barbecue smoke coming from somewhere nearby. Annabeth must have heard my stomach growl. She told me to go on. She'd catch me later. I left her on the pier, tracing her finger across the rail as if drawing a battle plan. Back at Cabin 11, everybody was talking and horsing around, waiting for dinner. For the first time, I noticed that a lot of the campers had similar features. Sharp noses, upturned eyebrows, mischievous smiles. They were the kind of kids that teachers would peg as troublemakers. Thankfully, nobody paid much attention to me as I walked over to my spot on the floor and plopped down with my minotaur horn. The counselor, Luke, came over. He had the Hermes family resemblance, too. It was marred by that scar on his right cheek, but his smile was intact.
"Found you a sleeping bag," he said. "And here, I stole you some toiletries from the camp store."
I couldn't tell if he was kidding about the stealing part. I said, "Thanks."
"No prob."
Luke sat next to me, pushed his back against the wall.
"Tough first day?"
"I don't belong here," I said. "I don't even believe in gods."
"Yeah, that's how we all started. Once you start believing in them, it doesn't get any easier."
The bitterness in his voice surprised me, because Luke seemed like a pretty easygoing guy. He looked like he could handle just about anything. "So your dad is Hermes?" I asked. He pulled a switchblade out of his back pocket, and for a second I thought he was going to gut me, but he just scraped the mud off the sole of his sandal.
"Yeah, Hermes.
The wing-footed messenger guy."
"That's him. Messengers, medicine, travelers, merchants, thieves, anybody who uses the roads. That's why you're here, enjoying Cabin 11's hospitality. Hermes isn't picky about who he sponsors."
I figured Luke didn't mean to call me a nobody. He just had a lot on his mind. "You ever meet your dad?" I asked.
"Once."
I waited, thinking that if he wanted to tell me, he'd tell me. Apparently he didn't. I wondered if the story had anything to do with how he got his scar. Luke looked up and managed to smile.
"Don't worry about it, Percy. The campers here, they're mostly good people. After all, we're extended family, right? We take care of each other."
He seemed to understand how lost I felt, and I was grateful for that because an older guy like him, even if he was a counselor, should have steered clear of an uncool middle schooler like me. But Luke had welcomed me into the cabin. He'd even stolen me some toiletries, which was the nicest thing anybody had done for me all day. I decided to ask him my last big question, the one that had been bothering me all afternoon. Clarice from Ares was joking about me being Big Three material. Then Annabeth, twice, she said I might be the one. She said I should talk to the Oracle. What was that all about?
Luke folded his knife. "I hate prophecies."
"What do you mean?"
His face twitched around the scar. "Let's just say I messed things up for everybody else. The last 2 years, ever since my trip to the Garden of the Hesperides went sour, Chiron hasn't allowed any more quests. Annabeth's been dying to get out into the world. She pestered Chiron so much, he finally told her he already knew her fate. He'd had a prophecy from the Oracle. He wouldn't tell her the whole thing, but he said Annabeth wasn't destined to go on a quest yet. She had to wait until somebody special came to the camp."
"Somebody special?"
"Don't worry about it, kid," Luke said. "Annabeth wants to think every new camper who comes through here is the omen she's been waiting for. Now come on, it's dinner time."
The moment he said it, a horn blew in the distance. Somehow, I knew it was a conch shell, even though I'd never heard one before.
Luke yelled, 11, fall in!
The whole cabin, about 20 of us, filed into the commons yard. We lined up in order of seniority, so, of course, I was dead last. Campers came from the other cabins, too, except for the three empty cabins at the end, and cabin 8, which had looked normal in the daytime, but was now starting to glow silver as the sun went down. We marched up the hill to the mess hall pavilion. Satyrs joined us from the meadow. Naiads emerged from the canoeing lake. A few other girls came out of the woods, and when I say out of the woods, I mean straight out of the woods. I saw one girl, about 9 or 10 years old, melt from the side of a maple tree and come skipping up the hill. In all, there were maybe 100 campers, a few dozen satyrs, and a dozen assorted wood nymphs and naiads. At the pavilion, torches blazed around the marble columns. A central fire burned in a bronze brazier the size of a bathtub. Each cabin had its own table, covered in white cloth trimmed in purple. 4 of the tables were empty, but cabin 11's was way overcrowded. I had to squeeze onto the edge of a bench with half my butt hanging off. I saw Grover sitting at table 12 with Mr. D, a few satyrs, and a couple of plump blonde boys who looked just like Mr. D. Chiron stood to one side, the picnic table being way too small for a centaur. Annabeth sat at table 6 with a bunch of serious-looking athletic kids, all with her gray eyes and honey-blonde hair. Clarice sat behind me at Ares' table. She'd apparently gotten over being hosed down because she was laughing and belching right alongside her friends. Finally, Chiron pounded his hoof against the marble floor of the pavilion, and everybody fell silent. He raised a glass.
To the gods!
Everybody raised their glasses.
To the gods!
Wood nymphs came forward with platters of food. Grapes, apples, strawberries, cheese, fresh bread, and yes, barbecue. My glass was empty, but Luke said,
speak to it, whatever you want, non-alcoholic, of course.
I said, cherry coke. The glass filled with sparkling caramel liquid. Then I had an idea. Blue cherry coke. The soda turned a violent shade of cobalt. I took a cautious sip. Perfect. I drank a toast to my mother. She's not gone, I told myself. Not permanently, anyway. She's in the underworld. And if that's a real place, then someday...
Here you go, Percy,
Luke said, handing me a platter of smoked brisket. I loaded my plate and was about to take a big bite when I noticed everybody getting up, carrying their plates toward the fire in the center of the pavilion. I wondered if they were going for dessert or something.
Come on, Luke told me.
As I got closer, I saw that everyone was taking a portion of their meal and dropping it into the fire. The ripest strawberry, the juiciest slice of beef, the warmest, most buttery roll. Luke murmured in my ear,
burnt offerings for the gods. They like the smell.
You're kidding. His look warned me not to take this lightly, but I couldn't help wondering why an immortal, all-powerful being would like the smell of burning food. Luke approached the fire, bowed his head, and tossed in a cluster of fat red grapes.
Hermes.
I was next. I wished I knew what God's name to say. Finally, I made a silent plea. Whoever you are, tell me, please. I scraped a big slice of brisket into the flames. When I caught a whiff of the smoke, I didn't gag. It smelled nothing like burning food. It smelled of hot chocolate and fresh baked brownies, hamburgers on the grill, and wildflowers, and 100 other good things that shouldn't have gone well together but did. I could almost believe the gods could live off that smoke. When everybody had returned to their seats and finished eating their meals, Chiron pounded his hoof again for our attention. Mr. D got up with a huge sigh.
Yes, I suppose I'd better say hello to all you brats. Well, hello. Our activities director, Chiron, says the next capture the flag is Friday. Cabin 5 presently holds the laurels.
A bunch of ugly cheering rose from the Ares table.
Personally, Mr. D continued, I couldn't care less, but congratulations.
Also, I should tell you that we have a new camper today, Peter Johnson.
Karen murmured something.
Percy Jackson, Mr. D corrected. That's right. Hurrah, and all that. Now run along to your silly campfire. Go on.
Everybody cheered. We all headed down toward the amphitheater, where Apollo's cabin led a sing-along. We sang camp songs about the gods, and ate s'mores and joked around, and the funny thing was, I didn't feel that anyone was staring at me anymore. I felt that I was home. Later in the evening, when the sparks from the campfire were curling into a starry sky, the Concorde blew again, and we all filed back to our cabins. I didn't realize how exhausted I was until I collapsed on my borrowed sleeping bag. My fingers curled around the Minotaur horn. I thought about my mom, but I had good thoughts. Her smile, the bedtime stories she would read me when I was a kid, the way she would tell me not to let the bedbugs bite. When I closed my eyes, I fell asleep instantly. That was my first day at Camp Half-Blood. I wish I'd known how briefly I would get to enjoy my new home. Chapter 8. We Capture a Flag. The next few days, I settled into a routine that felt almost normal, if you don't count the fact that I was getting lessons from satyrs, nymphs, and a centaur. Each morning I took ancient Greek from Annabeth, and we talked about the gods and goddesses in the present tense, which was kind of weird. I discovered Annabeth was right about my dyslexia. Ancient Greek wasn't that hard for me to read, at least no harder than English. After a couple of mornings, I could stumble through a few lines of Homer without too much headache. The rest of the day, I'd rotate through outdoor activities, looking for something I was good at. Chiron tried to teach me archery, but we found out pretty quick I wasn't any good with a bow and arrow. He didn't complain, even when he had to desnag a stray arrow out of his tail. Foot racing? No good either. The wood nymph instructors left me in the dust. They told me not to worry about it. They'd had centuries of practice running away from lovesick gods. But still, it was a little humiliating to be slower than a tree. And wrestling? Forget it. Every time I got on the mat, Clarice would pulverize me. "There's more where that came from, punk," she'd mumble in my ear. The only thing I really excelled at was canoeing, and that wasn't the kind of heroic skill people expected to see from the kid who had beaten the Minotaur. I knew the senior campers and counselors were watching me, trying to decide who my dad was, but they weren't having an easy time of it. I wasn't as strong as the Ares kids, or as good at archery as the Apollo kids. I didn't have Hephaestus's skill with metalwork, or, gods forbid, Dionysus's way with vine plants. Luke told me I might be a child of Hermes, a kind of jack-of-all-trades, master of none. But I got the feeling he was just trying to make me feel better. He really didn't know what to make of me either. Despite all that, I liked camp. I got used to the morning fog over the beach, the smell of hot strawberry fields in the afternoon, even the weird noises of monsters in the woods at night. I would eat dinner with Cabin 11, scrape part of my meal into the fire, and try to feel some connection to my real dad. Nothing came. Just that warm feeling I'd always had, like the memory of his smile. I tried not to think too much about my mom, but I kept wondering, if gods and monsters were real, if all this magical stuff was possible, surely there was some way to save her, to bring her back. I started to understand Luke's bitterness and how he seemed to resent his father, Hermes. So, okay, maybe gods had important things to do, but couldn't they call once in a while, or a thunder or something? Dionysus could make a Diet Coke appear out of thin air. Why couldn't my dad, whoever he was, make a phone appear? Thursday afternoon, 3 days after I'd arrived at Camp Half-Blood, I had my first sword-fighting lesson. Everybody from Cabin 11 gathered in the big circular arena, where Luke would be our instructor. We started with basic stabbing and slashing, using some straw-stuffed dummies in Greek armor. I guess I did okay. At least, I understood what I was supposed to do and my reflexes were good. The problem was, I couldn't find a blade that felt right in my hands. Either they were too heavy, or too light, or too long. Luke tried his best to fix me up, but he agreed that none of the practice blades seemed to work for me. We moved on to dueling in pairs. Luke announced he would be my partner since this is my first time.
Good luck, one of the campers told me. Luke's the best swordsman in the last 300 years.
Maybe he'll go easy on me, I said.
The camper snorted. Luke showed me thrusts and parries and shield blocks the hard way. With every swipe, I got a little more battered and bruised.
Keep your guard up, Percy, he'd say, then whap me in the ribs with the flat of his blade.
No, not that far up.
Whap. Lunge. Whap. Now back. Whap.
By the time he called a break, I was soaked in sweat. Everybody swarmed the drinks cooler. Luke poured ice water on his head, which looked like such a good idea. I did the same. Instantly, I felt better. Strength surged back into my arms. The sword didn't feel so awkward.
Okay, everybody, circle up, Luke ordered. If Percy doesn't mind, I want to show you a little demo.
Great, I thought. Let's all watch Percy get pounded.
The Hermes guys gathered around. They were suppressing smiles. I figured they'd been in my shoes before and couldn't wait to see how Luke used me for a punching bag. He told everybody he was going to demonstrate a disarming technique, how to twist the enemy's blade with the flat of your own sword so that he had no choice but to drop his weapon.
This is difficult, he stressed. I've had it used against me. No laughing at Percy now. Most swordsmen have to work years to master this technique.
He demonstrated the move on me in slow motion. Sure enough, the sword clattered out of my hand.
Now in real time, he said, after I'd retrieved my weapon. We keep sparring until one of us pulls it off. Ready, Percy?
I nodded, and Luke came after me. Somehow, I kept him from getting a shot at the hilt of my sword. My senses opened up. I saw his attacks coming. I countered. I stepped forward and tried a thrust of my own. Luke deflected it easily, but I saw a change in his face. His eyes narrowed, and he started to press me with more force. The sword grew heavy in my hand. The balance wasn't right. I knew it was only a matter of seconds before Luke took me down, so I figured, what the heck? I tried the disarming maneuver. My blade hit the base of Luke's, and I twisted, putting my whole weight into a downward thrust. Clang! Luke's sword rattled against the stones. The tip of my blade was an inch from his undefended chest. The other campers were silent. I lowered my sword.
Sorry.
For a moment, Luke was too stunned to speak.
Sorry?
His scarred face broke into a grin.
By the gods, Percy, why are you sorry? Show me that again.
I didn't want to. The short burst of manic energy had completely abandoned me. But Luke insisted. This time, there was no contest. The moment our swords connected, Luke hit my hilt and sent my weapon skidding across the floor. After a long pause, somebody in the audience said,
"Beginner's luck?"
Luke wiped the sweat off his brow.
He appraised me with an entirely new interest.
"Maybe," he said, "but I wonder what Percy can do with a balanced sword."
Friday afternoon, I was sitting with Grover at the lake, resting from a near-death experience on the climbing wall. Grover had scampered to the top like a mountain goat, but the lava had almost gotten me. My shirt had smoking holes in it. The hairs had been singed off my forearms. We sat on the pier, watching the naiads do underwater basket weaving, until I got up the nerve to ask Grover how his conversation had gone with Mr. D. His face turned a sickly shade of yellow.
Fine, he said. Just great.
So your career's still on track?
He glanced at me nervously.
Chiron told you I want a searcher's license?
Well, no.
I had no idea what a searcher's license was, but it didn't seem like the right time to ask.
He just said you had big plans, you know, and that you needed credit for completing a keeper's assignment. So did you get it?
Grover looked down at the naiads.
Mr. D suspended judgment. He said I hadn't failed or succeeded with you yet, so our fates were still tied together. If you got a quest, and I went along to protect you, and we both came back alive, then maybe he'd consider the job complete.
My spirits lifted.
Well, that's not so bad, right?
Blah,
He might as well have transferred me to stable cleaning duty. The chances of you getting a quest, and even if you did, why would you want me along? Of course I'd want you along. Grover stared glumly into the water. Basket weaving. Must be nice to have a useful skill. I tried to reassure him that he had lots of talents, but that just made him look more miserable. We talked about canoeing and swordplay for a while, then debated the pros and cons of the different gods. Finally, I asked him about the 4 empty cabins.
Number 8, the silver one, belongs to Artemis, he said. She vowed to be a maiden forever, so of course, no kids. The cabin is, you know, honorary. If she didn't have one, she'd be mad.
Yeah, okay, but the other 3, the ones at the end, are those the big 3?
Grover tensed. We were getting close to a touchy subject.
No. One of them, number 2, is Hera's, he said. That's another honorary thing. She's the goddess of marriage, so of course she wouldn't go around having affairs with mortals. That's her husband's job. When we say the big 3, we mean the 3 powerful brothers, the sons of Kronos. Zeus, Poseidon, Hades.
Right, you know.
After the great battle with the Titans, they took over the world from their dad and drew lots to decide who got what.
Zeus got the sky, I remembered, Poseidon the sea, Hades the underworld.
Uh-huh.
But Hades doesn't have a cabin here.
No, he doesn't have a throne on Olympus either. He sort of does his own thing down in the underworld.
If he did have a cabin here, Grover shuddered.
Well, it wouldn't be pleasant. Let's leave it at that.
But Zeus and Poseidon, they both had like a bazillion kids in the myths. Why are their cabins empty?
Grover shifted his hooves uncomfortably.
About 60 years ago, after World War II, the Big 3 agreed they wouldn't sire any more heroes. Their children were just too powerful. They were affecting the course of human events too much, causing too much carnage. World War II, you know, that was basically a fight between the sons of Zeus and Poseidon on one side and the sons of Hades on the other. The winning side, Zeus and Poseidon, made Hades swear an oath with them, no more affairs with mortal women. They all swore on the river Styx.
Thunder boomed.
I said, that's the most serious oath you can make.
Grover nodded.
And the brothers kept their word, no kids?
Grover's face darkened.
17 years ago, Zeus fell off the wagon. There was this TV starlet with a big fluffy 80s hairdo. He just couldn't help himself. When their child was born, a little girl named Thalia, well, the river Styx is serious about promises. Zeus himself got off easy because he's immortal, but he brought a terrible fate on his daughter.
But that isn't fair. It wasn't the little girl's fault.
Grover hesitated.
Percy, children of the Big 3 have powers greater than other half-bloods. They have a strong aura, a scent that attracts monsters. When Hades found out about the girl, he wasn't too happy about Zeus breaking his oath. Hades let the worst monsters out of Tartarus to torment Thalia. A satyr was assigned to be her keeper when she was 12, but there was nothing he could do. He tried to escort her here with a couple of other half-bloods she'd befriended. They almost made it. They got all the way to the top of that hill. He pointed across the valley to the pine tree where he'd fought the Minotaur. All 3 kindly ones were after them, along with a horde of hellhounds. They were about to be overrun when Thalia told her satyr to take the other 2 half-bloods to safety while she held off the monsters. She was wounded and tired, and she didn't want to live like a hunted animal. The satyr didn't want to leave her, but he couldn't change her mind, and he had to protect the others, so Thalia made her final stand alone at the top of that hill. As she died, Zeus took pity on her. He turned her into that pine tree. Her spirit still helps protect the borders of the valley. That's why the hill is called Half-Blood Hill. I stared at the pine in the distance. The story made me feel hollow, and guilty too. A girl my age had sacrificed herself to save her friends. She had faced a whole army of monsters. Next to that, my victory over the Minotaur didn't seem like much. I wondered, If I'd acted differently, could I have saved my mother?
Grover, I said, have heroes really gone on quests to the underworld?
Sometimes, he said, Orpheus, Hercules, Houdini.
And have they ever returned somebody from the dead?
No, never.
Orpheus came close.
Percy, you're not seriously thinking.
No.
I lied. I was just wondering, so a satyr is always assigned to guard a demigod?
Grover studied me warily. I hadn't persuaded him that I'd really dropped the underworld idea.
Not always. We go undercover to a lot of schools. We try to sniff out the half-bloods who have the makings of great heroes. If we find one with a very strong aura, like a child of the Big Three, we alert Chiron. He tries to keep an eye on them, since they could cause really huge problems.
And you found me. Chiron said you thought I might be something special.
Grover looked as if I'd just let him into a trap.
I didn't...
Oh, listen, don't think like that. If you were, you know, you'd never ever be allowed a quest, and I'd never get my license. You're probably a child of Hermes, or maybe even one of the minor gods, like Nemesis, the god of revenge. Don't worry, okay?
I got the idea he was reassuring himself more than me.
The night after dinner, there was a lot more excitement than usual. At last, it was time for capture the flag. When the plates were cleared away, the conch horn sounded and we all stood at our tables. Campers yelled and cheered as Annabeth and two of her siblings ran into the pavilion carrying a silk banner. It was about 10 feet long, glistening gray, with a painting of a barn owl above an olive tree. From the opposite side of the pavilion, Clarice and her buddies ran in with another banner of identical size, but gaudy red, painted with a bloody spear and a boar's head. I turned to Luke and yelled over the noise,
"Those are the flags?"
"Yeah."
"Ares and Athena always lead the teams?"
"Not always," he said, "but often."
"So if another cabin captures one, what do? Repaint the flag?" He grinned.
"You'll see. First we have to get one."
"Whose side are we on?"
He gave me a sly look as if he knew something I didn't. The scar on his face made him look almost evil in the torchlight.
"We've made a temporary alliance with Athena. Tonight, we get the flag from Ares, and you are gonna help."
The teams were announced. Athena had made an alliance with Apollo and Hermes, the two biggest cabins. Apparently, privileges had been traded, shower times, chore schedules, the best slots for activities, in order to win support. Ares had allied themselves with everybody else, Dionysus, Demeter, Aphrodite, and Hephaestus. From what I'd seen, Dionysus' kids were actually good athletes, but there were only two of them. Demeter's kids had the edge with nature skills and outdoor stuff, but they weren't very aggressive. Aphrodite's sons and daughters I wasn't too worried about. They mostly sat out every activity and checked their reflections in the lake and did their hair and gossiped. Hephaestus's kids weren't pretty, and there were only four of them, but they were big and burly from working in the metal shop all day. They might be a problem. That, of course, left Ares' cabin. A dozen of the biggest, ugliest, meanest kids on Long Island, or anywhere else on the planet. Chiron hammered his hoof on the marble.
"Heroes," he announced. "You know the rules. The creek is the boundary line. The entire forest is fair game. All magic items are allowed. The banner must be prominently displayed and have no more than 2 guards. Prisoners may be disarmed, but may not be bound or gagged. No killing or maiming is allowed. I will serve as referee and battlefield medic. Arm yourselves!"
He spread his hands, and the tables were suddenly covered with equipment. Helmets, bronze swords, spears, oxide shields coated in metal.
"Whoa," I said, "we're really supposed to use these?"
Luke looked at me as if I were crazy.
"Unless you want to get skewered by your friends in Cabin 5. Here, Chiron thought these would fit. You'll be on border patrol."
My shield was the size of an NBA backboard, with a big caduceus in the middle. It weighed about 1,000,000 pounds.
I could have snowboarded on it fine, but I hope nobody seriously expected me to run fast.